Welcome to WISO Weekend, WYSO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, we'll talk with artist Greg Durth. The Dayton Native's work has taken a creative turn, and we'll hear about that as he gets ready for a gallery show next week. Also on today's program, the music of one of our favorite young bands, Wheels. They stopped by the studios and played some tunes for us on Thursday, so we'll hear some of that later in the show. But first, last week, President Obama visited the home of his ancestors, the tiny town of Moneygall in Ireland. This evening at 6 o'clock, we'll bring you the North American premiere of a radio documentary called Barack Obama, The Road from Moneygall, by Irish producer Mary Phelan. WYSO's Emily McCord had the chance to speak with Mary Phelan and Obama's distant cousin, Roger Carney, when they visited our studios last week. As the conversation begins, Mary tells us how she stumbled onto The Road from Moneygall.
Well, it came to me in rather a strange way, actually. There's a group of Irish musicians called the Corrigan Brothers, and they somehow or other heard about this before ever I did. And they recorded this very, very funny video and wrote this song called There's No One As Irish As Barack Obama. It was an internet hit, and that's how I actually came across the story first. Subsequently, an Irish publisher who is since deceased, Steve McDonough, wrote a book on the subject. But the song and the video, especially the original video that goes with it, is such a brilliant, funny piece of pop art. It really was amazing.
Can you describe the song for me a little
bit? I could try singing a verse.
Oh, please, please.
It goes, O'Leary, O'Reilly, O'Haron, O'Hara, there's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. From the old Blarney Stone to the green hills of Tara,
there's no one as Irish as Barack Obama. 2008, the White House is green. They're cheering in Mayo and in Skibbereen. The Irish in Kenya and in Yokohama.
And it goes on from there.
So you hear this song, and what's your first reaction?
Well, well, I can't remember, actually, because it's quite a while ago. But I thought, wow, amazing. Is this true? And I thought, what a funny song and what a funny story and how unlikely, because obviously the whole focus. Now, I discovered this before the election. And I did actually try to get a group of people out to do a pub crawl of Galway, singing the song in four-part harmony on the night of the inauguration. However, I failed miserably, and it's one of my life regrets that I didn't manage that. Only three of the people who turned up could sing.
So when did you realise that this story was more than just a song and that it had legs to it?
Well, I realised from the beginning that, you know, as I said, it was very unlikely, or at least struck me as very unlikely at the time, given that the whole focus generally of media coverage and everybody's, you know, the way that everybody was so interested in Barack Obama was all about his African ancestry. And certainly the idea that he had Irish was, you know, tickled me pink, I suppose. But then subsequently I came across a book written on the subject, which was extremely well researched and which Roger was actually quite closely involved in the writing of, in as much as he met up with the late Steve McDonough. And Roger was also quite central to the whole connection being made, which was made via an American genealogist called Megan Smolenak. Roger can probably take up the story there because he was involved at that time.
Sure. Yes, I have been doing my family history, the Kearney family, for about 20 years. And in doing that, I found, luckily, a map from 1860 that showed where my great-grandparents and my great-great-grandparents lived in Ross County, northwest Ross County. And it shows where the farm was and other properties in the area. And right across the road from where my great-grandparents lived was a property that had the name Fulmouth Carney on it. And I was not familiar with that name, and I had done a lot of research, and I didn't know who it was. I tried to find more information. The only thing I could find was he was listed in the 1860 census, but I didn't know who it was, but I wasn't too worried about it. But then it was several years later, I think it was in 2007, when I read in the newspaper and the first article that I had seen that said that they thought Barack Obama had Irish ancestors and that his immigrant ancestor was named Fulmouth Carney. And of course, that rang a bell in my head, and I ran to my computer and I pulled the information up and compared what the newspaper had, and it was a match, no question about it.
So what was your reaction when you found this out?
I was thrilled. Now, I had heard, I was familiar with Obama, of course, and I had heard that famous speech he made at the Democratic Convention in 2004. At the time, I was so impressed with him. I just thought, what a wonderful speaker, and it seemed like he had a great mind, and would I've never thinking that I might be related to him. So when I got in, then I contacted Megan Smolniak, and we exchanged information. I gave her a little information. She gave me a lot of information, and that helped my research, and I think I helped her research, and we continued on there. And it was, it really was quite interesting. So I'm Barack Obama's fourth cousin, three times removed.
Can you tell me a little bit about the Carney family?
Sure. Well, my research has taken me back as far as the mid-1700s in Monegal and in a small town near there, Shinrone, in Offaly County. Was called King's County at that time. And I've traced my ancestors. My immigrant ancestor was Thomas Carney, who came to the United States in sometime around 1790. We know he was married in Baltimore and lived in Baltimore for about 10 years before the family moved here. They came to Ohio. He first came by himself to Ohio in 1801, before Ohio was a state, and then went back to Baltimore and brought the family out here in about, was 1804, when his wife's mother died. Her father had died a few years before that. So they brought the family, small children, out here. They came out here. Well, when Thomas came out here, I think he came out horseback and walking down through Tennessee and up from Tennessee into Ohio to the area where Chillicothe, Ohio is, and then found the place he liked in northwest Ross County and started the home there. And then when he brought the family back, we think probably by that time there were probably and roads were good enough that he could have had a wagon or something, but we don't know any of that detail yet. But they lived there then, the various generations. His other family members were still in Ireland, but after a few years started to come over here. Some of his siblings came over, and then he started having nephews come over. And in 1850 is when Barack Obama's immigrant ancestor, Fulmouth, came over because he had been left some property. Of course, 1850, that was during the potato famine, and there was great stress on the people of Ireland. And so I would assume he saw this as an opportunity and that he just simply couldn't afford. His parents were already, or his father was already here. His mother stayed behind for another year or so and then came over. Now, they are both buried in Fayette County, very near the intersection of Ross County and Pickaway County, where those three counties come together. They lived. Thomas lived about a mile east of that point where the three counties come together, and the cemetery that Mary and I visited the other day was it's about half a mile west of that. So they're close, but it made it somewhat confusing in doing the genealogy because some of the records were in Pickaway County, some were in Ross County, some were in Fayette County, and it took me a while to find the right place.
I'm curious, with President Obama, when you found out that there was this connection, did you try to contact him or reach out in any way?
No. I figured he had plenty to deal with. I did hear a little story, though, just before the 2008 election. The Cleveland Plain Dealer did an article. And they came down, or I met them, and I took them through the cemetery where my ancestors and some of his ancestors are buried. And they put a nice piece together that appeared in the Plain Dealer. And after that, then I was contacted by a lot of folks and did a few other interviews and so forth. But I heard then a few days later that Ted Strickland, the governor of Ohio at the time, had read the article and was impressed with it, and that he mentioned it to Barack Obama when he was here campaigning, and that's when he was told that Barack Obama has cousins everywhere. And of course, since then, we know that really is true.
And he's embracing his Irish heritage. Tell me about what's happening.
Well, there's great excitement in Ireland. I mean, the village of Moneygall, which is where the Carnies came from, is a tiny little village. It has a population of about 250 people. There are 58 children in the school there. It's a very tiny village. It's actually a very nondescript village. It is not spectacularly beautiful. It's in the centre of Ireland, so it's quite flat, very like Fayette and Ross County, funnily enough, really strangely, like physically, like the place where the Carnies moved to in the States. But the discovery, the very unlikely discovery of the connection with Barack Obama in 2007 has given this tiny village in Ireland the most incredible lift at a time when Ireland has been in a very bad state economically and as a result socially, psychologically. But and in some ways, that in some ways, apart from the quirky unlikeliness of the connection, to me, that's actually a very interesting story, because the people in Moneygall have been insulated from the recession which has hit Ireland so badly as a result of the Obama connection. There are two pubs in the village. One of them doesn't even have a television. It's so quaint and old fashioned. The other one does and has an Obama corner, complete with an Obama cutout. And they don't talk recession in that pub. They talk about their boy in the White House every time there's a news bulletin. Ah, there's our lad doing well. So it's been fantastic for Moneygall. They have embraced it fully. They are thrilled at the visit. They didn't anticipate. Well, they did hope that there was going to be a visit, but they certainly didn't anticipate it happening this year.
For you, Mary, I'm wondering what's the thing that you'll take away from doing this documentary?
I think a huge respect for the strength of the people who made that journey. Because I was fairly determined to try and do it as close to the original journey as possible, and also to try to do it by public transport in the interests of keeping my carbon emissions somewhat under control, given that I'd flown across the Atlantic to do this. However, I gave up. I did take the train as far as Charleston in West Virginia. And that, and I mean, I travelled, you know, in the 21st century, fairly healthy, good catering, on a 21st century train. I was tired by the time I got to Charleston, West Virginia, and I drove from there. They did this absolutely incredibly physically strenuous journey under very different conditions and having had a very different transit across the Atlantic. And as I was saying, I travelled in 21st century comfort for this project, which of course was only possible because I did get funding to make the documentary from the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. We have a funding scheme in Ireland, quite a good one, that funds quality programmes on exploring Irish language, culture, heritage and experience. So this one pretty well, and lesser known aspects of same. So this one pretty well ticked all the boxes. So I have to say, I am full of admiration for these people and their physical strength.
I've been speaking with Mary Phelan, and also here was Roger Carney. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
The Road from Moneygall airs tonight at 6 on 91.3 WYSO. And now here's Sarah Buckingham to tell us about the Moth Radio Hour.
Coming up tonight at 11 p.m., old-fashioned storytelling on modern life. On this week's episode, the mother of a bullied teen tells the story of his suicide. Ex-New York City Mayor Ed Koch stands up to his anti-Semitic platoon leader while in training for World War II. Three teenagers from Grace King High School in New Orleans share their stories on the theme of prejudice and power. And double amputee Amy Mullins chronicles her adventures with prosthetic legs as an athlete, actress, and artist.
I'm a bit of a daredevil. I think that the nurses at DuPont Institute would agree. I spent a lot of time there as a child. Doctors amputated both of my legs below the knee when I was an infant, and then when I was five, I had a major surgery to correct the wonky direction in which my tibia was growing. So I had two metal pins to hold that, full plaster cast on both legs. I had to use a wheelchair because I couldn't wear prosthetics. And one of the best things about getting out of the hospital is the anticipation of the day you return to school. You know, I had missed so much class. I just couldn't wait to get back and see all my friends. But my teacher had a different idea about that. She tried to prevent me from returning to class because she said that in the condition I was in, I was inappropriate and that I would be a distraction to the other students, which of course I was, but not because of the cast in the wheelchair. Clearly, she needed to make my difference invisible because she wanted to control her environment and make it fit into her idea of what normal looked like.
The Moth is true stories told live without notes. Some stories are emotionally intense and not for children. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by The Moth and Jay Allison of Atlantic Public Media. Hear The Moth Radio Hour tonight at 11 p.m. right here on WYSO.
Also coming up next week during Morning Edition, WYSO will present a five-part series called The New Face of Wright Patt. We'll look at the impact of the 2005 base realignment and closure that's bringing new missions to the base and new economic possibilities to the Miami Valley. Up next on WYSO Weekend, artist Greg Durth says his work has taken a new direction over the years, and this week, new paintings from the artist will be seen for the first time at Dayton's Gallery 510 in the Oregon District. Durth grew up in West Carrollton, received a fine arts degree from Ohio State University. He did some artwork for WYSO back in the 80s, but his focus was mainly in commercial art. Today on WYSO Weekend, Durth talks about the new collaborative nature of his art.
So for this show that's coming up, it represents yet a new little change for me. I was doing commission portraits, which you might call straight, you know, just rather straightforward depictions of people, and most still lifes and landscapes. I'm a realist painter. I work in realism. But that, eventually I came to a place where I wasn't feeling too plugged in, as one person put it. And I was casting about looking for an answer like, well, what would I like to paint? And I realized I wanted to paint some people, but I didn't want it just to be a commission, a straight commissioned portrait where I was duty-bound to the client. I wanted to use my imagination a little more. And that's what these all are. They represent kind of a collaboration with me and the models, kind of probing both my little initial vision for the piece and also adding into it their inner world and trying to find what makes them unique. Because I guess if there's a theme to the show, it has something to do with the fact that I think people today, in this society at least, are really free to form themselves and live in their own little world to a degree. You know, we all have our own little tribe of friends and family who have perhaps very different likes, dislikes, interests from the person that lives maybe right next door to them. You know, it's we have a lot of freedom, and in that and with that has come a lot of diversity of personal experience. And these paintings are kind of an attempt to portray the internal world of the things that loom large in the minds of the models or maybe me.
It's an interesting connection that you've made, and you're getting, from what I can tell, a good response on it.
Oh, oddly enough, yeah. I've gotten a rise out of a lot of people in a lot of different places. Some people have put these things on Facebook, and I've emailed pictures to people and stuff. And it's not uncommon for friends and acquaintances to say, oh, beautiful, strong work, wonderful. But this has been different. This has been, it seems like has gotten people excited more than I anticipated, you know. And it just tickles me to death because that's the goal of anybody in the arts. You don't do it for yourself. If you did, you'd just sit home on the couch and think about it. You know, the whole thing is a response from whoever you put it out to. And I've been getting a great response on these, yeah.
Let's talk just for a minute about a little bit more about the process you go through with interpreting what the models bring to the table. How do you take their thoughts, and then what kind of efforts do you put forth to get that onto the canvas?
I'll give you a very particular answer to this. I'll take a painting, the one I did of Amy Anderson, who Amy works right here at Rosewood, and she's a local artist who has had many shows around here herself. And about a year ago, I had an idea just pop in my head, and who knows where these ideas come from, but I saw a woman. I thought it was a dark piece, maybe someone wearing black even. I wasn't sure. You just have these vague visions, you know. But a woman sitting on a stool or a seat of some kind, holding a martini glass with green liquid in it, like the evil queen in Snow White or something. And that was just the beginning of the idea. And I even had someone, and I knew she was going to wear glasses. I had glasses in my head for some reason. And when I first approached the first person I thought might be who I was thinking of, they had no interest whatsoever. It just went right over their head. And I let it drop to Amy, and she jumped at it. She says, "Oh, I'd love to do that." I said, "Well, all right." I said, "Next week we'll get together and I'll sketch out some things." Well, Amy went shopping. And first thing she did was she found this almost god-awful lime green cocktail jacket of fur in some thrift store, you know. And when I showed up at her house, that wasn't what I'd pictured at all. I'd pictured something dark. This thing is like neon, you know. But we went through her stuff. We looked at some of her clothes and looked at some of her jewelry and looked at her and I questioned her about her likes and dislikes. And one of the things she liked, as it turns out, was bugs. And she had this really cool necklace with a big locust, brass or bronze locust hanging on it, and a scarab bracelet, and et cetera. So I took some pictures, I did some drawings, and I went home to think about it. And while I was thinking about it, I was gardening out, it was in the fall, and as I was weeding, I found this big green praying mantis at the end of the summer, you know. And I got to thinking of Amy in that green coat, and how she'd been sitting with her wrist kind of broken like this, you know, just the way a praying mantis kind of has that bent thing. And I said, "Oh, man, there's something there, you know, I've got to put this praying mantis in it." And so then Amy came down to the house and for the initial actual painting session, and I'd already told her this about the praying mantis. And so she had done her hair up with these braided knots up on top of her head like two big praying mantis eyes. So she's into it. And so the painting turned out fabulous with this giant praying mantis behind her. She's sitting like I had envisioned with the green jacket, but with this giant predator, you know, menacingly back in the dark behind her, you know. Well, so the painting turned out different than I originally thought. Although it has, I mean, she's holding the martini glass, she's sitting on the stool, but she brought things to it. Her likes and interests led it off in a different direction too. So it's a real collaboration. It's like making a movie, only you're just really concentrating on one iconographic frame. You got an actor and you got a director, and that's, you know, the painter is the director and Amy was the actor. And it's exciting because it's more than either person could do on their own in a way, you know.
Models and Muses, New Portraits by Greg Durth opens first Friday, June 3rd from 5 to 10 p.m. at Gallery 510 in the Oregon District. It runs through June 25th. On this Memorial Day weekend, WYSO honors military men and women serving in the armed forces. Events are taking place throughout the area in observance of the day, and in today's Miami Valley Story Corps, Rainy Day Crow of Brookville brought her longtime friend Ann Branning to the StoryCorps booth just before Ann left Yellow Springs for New York City. In this very emotional interview, Ann shares memories of her brother David, a Marine who died in Fallujah on November 12, 2004. He was 21 years old.
Tell me about David.
I think I can safely say that he is literally the most amazing person I will ever meet in my life. David was a very creative person. Went to school at Carver Center of the Arts in Baltimore for drawing. And then hit a wall and realized that he was going nowhere where he was. He was getting into trouble. He was drinking too much, and made a decision to go into the Marine Corps.
What do you think being in the Marines gave to David, did for him?
A sense of accomplishment.
Yeah.
A sense of purpose. I remember him saying something to me on the phone. Because finances were always in his mind. How am I going to make some money? And there was a moment where he said, you know, if I get killed, do you know how much money you guys are going to get? And I hung up the phone on him. But I think it gave him that security for his family and for himself, that his life was on the right track.
Do you remember when you got the news?
Oh, yeah. It's hard to forget. I got out of work and there was a voicemail from my father. And I didn't want to call back. I would have given anything to not call back. But you do. So I did. And I locked myself in the bathroom, and I heard the words, I have to tell you that David died. And I said, don't you lie to me. Don't you lie to me. And he said, I'm not lying. I'm not lying. And then I knew that for the rest of my life, half of me would be missing.
What do you wish you had told him? What do you wish you could tell him now?
That there has not been one moment that I have not been proud of him. One of the things that he's taught me is to live with everything you have. And I'm going to keep doing that.
Ann Branning and her friend Rainy Day Crow at StoryCorps in Dayton, Ohio. Their conversation was edited by WYSO volunteer Justin Vanderberg. It will be archived in the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress and on the WYSO website at wyso.org. Tonight at Canal Street Tavern in Dayton, one of our favorite boy bands, Wheels, will have their first CD release party. And just this past Thursday, they hit the WYSO studios for another live performance. Just fall. The Tired Eyes Waltz, music from Wheels on WISO. A big thank you and congratulations to the guys on the release of their first CD, Fields on Fire, produced by Exceptional Sounds mastermind Tim Berger. That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. Thanks to all our guests on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and WYSO.org. Up next, The Book Nook. You're